faces, maybe, see if there's any new faces. But if I don't know you, then I'd love to say hello afterwards. This is a important topic. I think some of what this touches on, although we'll try to stay focused, but some of what this touches on has been a point of contention, I guess, and debate from the very early times of the oral Torah process. So from Talmudic times and prior to Talmudic times and the times of the Mishnah, we had many breakaway sects within Judaism, and lots of the time the discussion was, well, what is the narrative that we employ to understand the written Torah, to understand divine revelation? So there are those who, the Karaites and so on, who took it to be more literal, but within the idea of interpretation, even the Christians, really, once struck me, I was watching a debate between a Judaism-Christianity debate, just really struck me, Christianity is a narrative, really, on Scripture. And in a certain sense, the understanding we have in the Torah, where Hashem puts it down for us very clearly, that, and this is just introduction, this is not the the primary focus right now, but we find very clearly in the Torah that we're meant to go and seek counsel from the high court, from the Sanhedrin, when we have matters of doubt. The Torah is meant to be a continued process of interpretation, application. So the era of the Mishnah and the Talmud was very focused on interpretation, and from that day on, we continue to a degree to interpret the Torah, but we are very focused now on application. So we have a new technology, we have electricity. We're not here to interpret Torah, we're here to apply Torah. And we want to know, well, what do these rules within Torah say about this evolving technology? And that becomes the ongoing kind of role that the halachic process plays. So what I want to focus on first is, in the first little section here, is the idea of codes. What does it mean that we have a code? What does it mean, a code of Jewish law? Is halacha something static? Does it exist in a code? Is it in a book? You can find it on, Wikipedia, right? Is it a list of just rules, information that's been codified, is static in the sense that this is the rule and this is how it's got to be and you got to stick to it? So really, if you go back to Talmudic times, it was a constant process of debate. Again, we have many things that were agreed upon, many forms of interpretation, many rules that were handed down at Sinai are very clear and well accepted, and they're not subject to debate. Now, much of the detail is subject to debate, and that's a process. This opinion, that opinion. The one thing we have that decides questions is the idea of majority. When you have a majority, you go with the majority. But otherwise, it's a constant debate. There's this opinion, and there's that opinion. So the first time we have the idea of a code, it's not really a code, it doesn't look like a code. You'd be very confused if you read it as a code. But the Talmud is really the first thing that becomes accepted by the Jewish people as the Rambam and others codify that. You had a question? Sorry, no? So the Rambam and others explain and define the Talmud this way. The Talmud is accepted by the Jewish people, and so conclusions that are in the Talmud are considered binding on the Jewish people. It's a consensus of the greatest rabbis of the time, and for generations, the Jewish people have accepted that upon themselves in practice. Practicing Jews have practiced the rabbinic law as codified, so to speak, although it's not laid down in a code, in the Talmud. So that's the Rambam and the introduction to the Mishnah Torah. Now, the Talmud is very confusing. If you've ever taken a stab at opening it, it's very confusing. If you're having trouble with it, that's a Rabbi Summers in the back. He specializes in simplifying that process. If you can give him a couple hours a week, he can help you with that. If you got 20 minutes a week, I don't know. But if you got a couple hours a week, he can help you with that. So we have a complex body of literature. We have this Talmudic process, which goes off on tangents, which is scattered, and there are contradictions, and there are different opinions. What do we do with this? And again, we have scenarios that arise that create varying customs. You know, just as an example, we have Rabbeinu Gershom's ban on polygamy is not based on Talmudic law. It's a new legislation, and now we have to look at custom. Is this something accepted by the broad Jewish people? Is this something accepted by this community versus that community? So it's not only in debate on do we rule like Rebbe Meir or do we rule like Rebbe Yehuda, but also we have new customs arising, and they're codified here but not there. They're found in Germany, but they're not found in Spain. So you have those kind of issues arising as well. So we have all this post-Talmudic halachic confusion. And now what do we do? So we have different codes. We have the Rambam wrote a code. We had the Rif, who wrote a concise version of the Talmud, which was an attempt at a code, whereas if he held like Rabbi Meir, not Rabbi Yehuda, he would make it known to you in his concise version of the Talmud, which cut out the agadic sections, that he was following Rabbi Yehuda and not Rabbi Meir. So that was an early take at writing a code. And then we have the Rush, who wrote also a concise version of the Talmud, of the halachic conclusions that he felt were the conclusions in the Talmud. So we have these three major pillars of halacha that in Rabbi Yosef Cairo's view, and Rabbi Yosef Cairo, of course, is the author of Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, the capital T, right, the code of Jewish law. So Rabbi Yosef Cairo attempted to pull together these three pillars of halacha, the Rush, Rambam, Rabbeinu Asher was the Rush, Rambam, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi is Rif. He pulls them together and says, when two out of three are going to go to the right, I go to the right. When two out of three go to the left, I go to the left. So right before the Rush, right before the Beis Yosef was the Tor. Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Asher was the son of the Rush. And he wrote something called the Torah, which divided halacha in a code form into four sections. We know the four sections of Shulchan Aruch that we're familiar with the division of four into monetary law, laws relating to marriage and divorce and everything around that. We have the laws of daily living, which deal with blessings, prayers, holidays, and so on, and Shabbos, of course. We have ritual law, which deals with kosher and mourning and a variety of other halachos. So we have four different sections of Shulchan Aruch. That's based on the formulation of the Torah, Ben Yaakov ben Asher, who wrote a code of sorts, but there's a lot going on in the Torah. So the Torah will tell you sometimes his opinion. Very often he'll follow his father's opinion, the Rush. But you don't get a consensus, meaning a broad look at what everyone believes and holds, and now what should we do? And that was the job of Rabbi Cairo and also his contemporary, the Ramah, in the Ashkenazic lands in Krakow. They were attempting to sift through all this information and say, well, so therefore, what should we do? What should I do? Right? I don't have 10 hours to spend researching what blessing to make on this soup. So what do I do now? Okay, well, look at the Code of Jewish Law. You get Rabbi Cairo's view of the consensus of poskim. So when he has 2 out of 3, he'll go with 2 out of 3. The Ramah is a bit more into taking a look at more recent authorities. Within Talmud, you find a concept that the halacha follows the later authority, and that is because as you go down the line of the transmission, the later authority, when they're true to the transmission, they're taking everything into account. So they're taking all the previous opinions into account. It's not just one opinion. It's more of a consensus. The Ramah tries to incorporate that. Also, the Ramah is very focused on customs. There are certain codes of customs in the Ashkenazic lands. That's Ramah's job. Okay, so just to recap section one and try to address a little bit of the question at the top, is the code of Jewish law that we have, what is that? Is that a static set book of rules, or is it simply an attempt at putting in writing at least one author's view of the halachic process? And I think the answer is the second. It's an attempt to put in writing the author's view of the halachic process and where the conclusions lead them. And in the case of the Shulchan Aruch, it's comprehensive. It's not just responsa, where I dealt with so many questions and I had the time to address so many issues and write them out, but it's supposed to be comprehensive and cover as wide of an array of scenarios that might come up as possible. Okay, my apologies there. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is go on to section 2, and what we'll try to do in the next little while is take a stab at some of the topics that, a few topics here, and see what exactly is this halachic process. Because taking a broad look, and I get this question a lot, which is why I thought of putting this into a class. Taking a look at Jewish law, we sometimes feel like, well, the rabbis, you know, membership at the shul is dropping, and they figured if they can't get young families to shul, they won't be able to put bread on the table. So they said, hey, we came up with this idea of an Eruv. So you're not supposed to really walk in the public domain in a street on Shabbos carrying something or pushing a stroller or whatever it is. Well, we came up with this idea that you put up a string and another string, and bola, you have a something that allows you to carry, right? What we call a loophole. That's what an Eruv starts to get that kind of flavor. Well, we have all this chametz, you know, we have this guy, you know, the rabbi's got a congregant with $50,000 worth of whiskey. He doesn't want to throw it away before Pesach for some reason. So he comes to the rabbi and says, what am I going to do? So the rabbi says, oh, you know what, just sign this thing and we'll sell it to some guy in Kansas and you're good to go. And so on and so forth. Many different examples. It would seem, some people, a friend of mine, called it halacha by convenience. And then when we have halacha by convenience, and then we come to the rabbis, you know, in today, and we say, well, we have this and this social issue, and they're like, oh, halacha, we can't. And they're like, what's this business about halacha? We can't. Whenever you wanted to, when you needed to fill the membership and get the Eruv up, you were hustling about the town, climbing ladders, but all of a sudden, you're just, you know, not willing to do anything. And it becomes, you know, that, so, to that I've gotten that from that kind of conversation, which was a fascinating conversation, from a number of people. And let's look at some of those issues and see what exactly does go on. So just to preface, the need is very important, whether it's a personal need or a community need. Need takes an important place in the halachic process. For example, there's a phrase in the Talmud, Kedaihu Rebbe Meir Lismoch Alav B'Shas Hadchak, which translates as roughly, Rebbe Meir is a big enough authority to rely on him in case of necessity. So Rebbe Meir, the Talmud says, was so brilliant, it was very difficult for his colleagues to really plumb the depths of his reasoning. And as a result, consensus very often didn't follow Rebbe Meir. However, Rebbe Meir's opinion was legitimate. It was a legitimate opinion. It wasn't the consensus. It was a legitimate opinion. Says the Talmud, again, you have to know how to apply this in real halachic life, but says the Talmud that you can rely on a minority opinion in case of necessity. For example, the Code of Jewish Law, there's a process in how to interpret it, because it's not always clear what he wants to tell you. Sometimes he says, the halacha is like this, but sometimes he says, some say the halacha is like that. And some say the halacha is like that. And you're like, okay, well, what do I do now? I could have gone to the Talmud for that, you know. it would have been cheaper to have just the Talmud on the shelf. Now I have to have the Shulchan Aruch too. I needed you to tell me that there's an opinion like this and an opinion like that. What does that help me? So there are certain rules of interpretation that have been handed down throughout the ages. And one of them is that when the Shulchan Aruch tells you, this is the halacha, however, some say that, then he means to tell you that this is the mainstream halacha, but this is a opinion you should be aware of. Now, the question that begs to be asked is, if the Shulchan Aruch's view is that the mainstream halacha is A, why would he invite, you know, confusion by saying, well, you should be aware of opinion B? What's the point of being aware of opinion B if the halacha generally follows opinion A? And the answer is because a halachic decisor, a rabbi, or whoever is qualified to make this decision, or if you're stuck on a desert island, if you have a Shulchan Aruch with you, you do it yourself, you need to judge the situation. And at times, it's completely appropriate and the absolutely right thing to do to go with opinion B, based on a variety of circumstances. Sometimes it's because there are other mitigating factors. For example, without really giving an example, but just to explain, sometimes you have a halachic question that has multiple factors and multiple reasons why it might be okay. And there's disagreements in each of those scenarios. right? So something happened in my kitchen sink with meat and milk, and then there was a hot water, and it was cold water, and it was from yesterday, and the day before. And as I add up all the different questions and trying to address this person who just called me to tell them whether their food is okay, whether their pot is okay, I have to address four different, in other words, four different questions need to be answered before I can arrive at a conclusion. And each of those questions are disagreements. So as I work through all of those questions, I begin to line up, well, if I need to jump through four hoops to make this a problem, okay, and in three of them, they're minority opinions, but there's still three different minority opinions lining up to say this is okay. So what I end up at the end of the day is not such a minority opinion, right? Because I had all these different opinions coming together because there's so many different factors. We'll see if we can give an example maybe soon, in a little bit. So that's just the sense of what goes on in the page of the Shulchan Aruch. So we're getting into the idea, the question of an Eruv and things like that, which deal with whether it's a community need or a personal need. We understand that the need is important. It's an important part of the question is the human factor. Is this pot that they have something they got in the dollar store that they really would rather throw away? So then maybe throw it away. Oh, this is an heirloom they got from their great-grandmother, so then we're going to look at it differently. It's not because halacha is by convenience. It's because we will delve into the halacha deeply, but when there are reasons to be lenient, when motivated, we'll apply those leniencies. When not motivated, it's from the dollar store, we may not be as quick to apply those leniencies. Any questions, comments? Keep moving. Make sense? Okay. So let's talk about an Eruv. So an Eruv is one of my pet subjects because I've had the privilege of being involved in Eruv for a while. So it can be a lot of fun on Friday afternoon, that's for sure. But let's talk a little bit about an Eruv. Okay, so the basic idea is that an interpretation of Torah law is that that's Talmudic, and as we said from the Rambam, binding upon the entire Jewish nation as far as the process of halacha is concerned. One of the applications, interpretations of the laws of Shabbos is not to carry something in a public domain, which we understand to include pushing a stroller, riding a bike, etc., etc. If someone has specific needs for transportation, mobility, there is an idea at times that certain things that you might schlep with you might be actually considered someone's feet or someone's hands. So there is that principle as well. So in certain situations with physical disabilities, whatever it is, there are some freestanding leniencies that have nothing to do with an Eruv. But that being said, it's very difficult to maintain community life if you can't get around with stuff. And so sometimes that stuff are people, like kids. And so we have this need to create an Eruv. So let's start break down the law, and then we'll get into the application. So what's the law? So we know that you're not supposed to transfer items from a public domain to a private domain. You're also not supposed to transfer items from one part of the public domain to another. And the way that the halachic process defines one part of the public domain to another is a 4-cubit area. 4 cubits, 4 amos is considered your area. When you're found within 4 amos, that's your space. There are halachic ramifications for that in terms of acquisitions. If something falls within your space, you may have a legal right to it in halacha in certain scenarios. So your space is defined by a roughly 7 square foot area around you. Carrying from there to the next area, so to speak, is considered a violation based on interpretation of the discussion of the Mishkan and the wagons that they had and so on and so forth, and also an oral tradition from Moshe. That's considered to be a biblical prohibition. Now, how do you or can you make a public thoroughfare into a private domain? So obviously, if I manage to buy a piece of I-70 from the state of Colorado, whatever, and I decide to build my house there, and that's just that, and it's too bad, and traffic has to be diverted, so now this is my house, and now is a private domain, I can now carry my drink from the living room to the dining room, because this is now my living room and dining room. This is not I-70 anymore. The question is, are there any ways to make that my house without actually building a house? So if you built a wall, that also, you know, if it wasn't a huge structure, but it was an actual gate, and you gated off a part of what was previously a public domain, and now, even if it's used by the public, but it has a wall around it, that would also be considered a private domain, because it is walled in on four sides. Let's understand that. So, what we have now, what we use for creating an Eruv, is what we call a Tzuras HaPesach. Now, a Tzuras HaPesach is a doorway. For example, if I don't want to make you turn around, but if you would be interested in turning around, you would notice, or if you happen to be sitting on that table, like Sheldon, you would notice that there's a mezuzah right on the side of that wall right there. And that's because where those doors are, even if there wouldn't be those accordion doors, that would perhaps, arguably, be considered a door frame. And a door frame, halachically, and we'll get into this in a minute, if that's biblical or rabbinic, but halachically, that has the status, halachically, objectively, meaning nothing to do with the fact that I need to fill up my membership. I have a sukkah that I'm looking to build, and I'm missing a wall in my sukkah. There's an application that says, if you take a side post, and put a top post running above side post A, and it runs across, and it covers the top of side post B, you've created a door frame, and that has halachic validity as a wall in select circumstances. Now, according to some opinions, this is a rabbinic concept, which applies when you need a rabbinic law. For example, a sukkah, biblically, can have less wall, but the rabbi said you need to add a bit more. Okay, well, one of the ways you can add a bit more wall is with what we call Tzuras HaPesach, a door frame. Going back to Eruv, the rabbi said, let's say Torah law says a public domain, like we have here in the comments, Rashi and Bahag, say a public domain is only, let's use Rav Moshe Feinstein's terminology, an area with a really serious population density. It has two to three or above million people in a city, in an area. That area takes on a status, according to Rav Moshe, of a biblical public domain. Absent of that kind of concentration in the population, the Torah would say this is not a public thoroughfare. And according to Torah law, you're allowed to carry here. And the rabbis came along and said, well, this looks like a public thoroughfare. And in order to keep the spirit of Shabbos, in order to keep this uniform, in order to maintain some standard sense of conduct on Shabbos, we're going to say that the definition of a public thoroughfare in rabbinic law is larger, is wider and broader than the narrow version in the biblical law that you need such and such a population density. So now we have, like we had in the case of the sukkah, a reality where according to Torah law, this is like my living room. I'm allowed to carry in this area according to Torah law. The rabbis came along and said, you are not. However, in rabbinic law, there are certain things that are called walls that are not considered maybe walls in Torah law. That's one way to look at it. Rambam has a different approach based on, you know, a variety of things. Rambam says, no, a Tzuras HaPesach, a door frame, is a wall in Torah law, but the rabbis actually were more strict and said you can only apply that in limited circumstances. So there may be two ways of looking at this. But in any case, we have a community. We have a city that is not, let's say, you know, not the largest city in the United States. So it doesn't meet Rav Moshe's requirements for a truly biblical public domain. So now we say, okay, well, we're allowed to wall this off with a doorway, with a door frame. Now, one of the innovative door frames we have here, just within a mile of where we sit today, is a tension wire, whatever you call it, electric cable, that's some 200 feet in the air. I think it looks like it's 200 feet. I think I was told it's more like 90, but it certainly looks like it's 200 feet in the air. It's one of those towers, if you've been to the Cherry Creek bike path, right at Cherry Creek Drive, just between Holly and I think it's Monaco. So there are two huge towers. And the very top wire over there is the Eruv. And that's the top post. The side post is at the bottom, at the bike path, is a sign that says, danger, don't climb. And that is about 4 feet tall. And the string on top of it is about 90 feet. Again, looks like 200. I'm told we lasered it, and I was told it's 90 feet in the air. And you're like scratching your head. And the truth is, you know, maybe there are better ways of doing it, but that's how they did it. But halachically, there's a principle called good asik, which means that if this is here, this is a wall. If this is a wall, it extends upward indefinitely. And that's a halachic principle that was handed down at Sinai. And these are the principles. These are the rules. So this danger sign goes up to the heavens. And on its journey up to the heavens, it bumps into this top wire. And I have a Suras HaPesach. I have this structure that is a door frame. So we can scratch our heads from today till tomorrow. Some would say, no, you should really build something that's visible. It's important. Whatever. But on purely technical terms, this is a door frame. And a door frame for a public domain like ours is a halachically acceptable way of walling off an area. So this area is now walled off. And again, are these halachic constructs that were invented to deal with community need? No. These are the idea that a wall goes up to the heavens is handed down at Sinai, has application in a whole array of halachos, from building a sukkah to everything else. And it's just a halachic principle. That's just a reality. It's just being applied to a modern community sense where we don't live in the ghetto, we don't have a wall around the little block that we Jews live on and so on. And so how do we apply that? Well, this is how we apply it. It's much more complex, obviously, and many people don't like it for a variety of reasons. One of them being, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, what does it say in the Shulchan Aruch? Remember the opinion A and opinion B thing? Well, in the Shulchan Aruch it says, a public thoroughfare is like what you would think. It's a public thoroughfare. The street is a public thoroughfare. And that's a biblically defined public domain. And you cannot wall that off with a door frame. If you want to wall that off, you need walls. That's what it says. And then he says, and some say, opinion B, and some say, which is the opinion of Rashi in his comments to the Talmud, and the Baal Halachos Gadolos, one of the early Rishonim, and some say that it needs to be 600,000 people walk down that street. Now, what is this number 600,000? It has to do with the number of people that the Torah tells us were in the desert. Is it a number of people who walk down a street? Is it pedestrians? Is it cars? Is it passengers in the car? And then we have Ramosha's idea of population density. But again, opinion A says that a street is a public thoroughfare. Public is public. If it's a street, it's a street. That's opinion A. According to opinion A, for the most part, we probably shouldn't have an Eruv. According to the some say, we do have an Eruv. So if we were starting from scratch, if we didn't know anything else, and all we did was look at this one line in Shulchan Aruch, we probably wouldn't have a community Eruv as we know it. A couple of things, one of them important, is custom. It became well accepted in many European cities to have an Eruv. That means that it became well accepted to rely on this second opinion, which again, it's Rashi, it's a big one, and the Bahag, right? These are real, well-rooted opinions. Who Rashi was not a pulpit rabbi, I don't think, wasn't looking to fill up his membership, he was just commenting on the Talmud, right? So we have these well-accepted opinions, not necessarily the mainstream in the Shulchan Aruch's view, that become accepted. So the Shulchan Aruch is the code of Jewish law, and we follow him 90% of the time, but not always. There are other opinions. And sometimes we will not follow the position that he takes. In this case, many communities, not all, have a custom to follow opinion B in the Shulchan Aruch. That's one way to explain why we have an Eruv. There are a number of other ways to explain it, and we'll leave it at that. Otherwise, we'll be here all day. Okay. Let's move on to case study number two. Yes?
So, on your example of the electrical posters and the sign, let's say there were three rabbis there, and two said it's not in a roof, and one said it is. Would you run with the majority of the three be there in that particular instance?
So I would ask all of them why they said what they said.
I know, right. It's a discussion, but eventually the conclusion was 2-1 no. Is the answer no?
There is a broad idea. In other words, we're going back to Talmudic times, we're going back to times when we had going even further back to that, we had the Sanhedrin in the Temple Mount. We had a real process of majority, which was like, this is a, today, to create majority is difficult. I mean, it's very difficult. Who's a rabbi? You know, question one. You know, so it's very, very difficult to do that. And not every rabbi, you know, not all rabbis were created equal. So if Rav Moshe Feinstein and all of his contemporaries, let's say we were, you know, to the date today is 1975, and Rav Moshe Feinstein and all of his caliber people, so to speak, are of one opinion, and me and all of my caliber, or most of my caliber people are like, we think something else. So what was that? Sheldon would go with Rabbi Feinstein over me, which is, I find, particularly insulting, but... what was that? He's a wise... Sheldon's a wise man, I have to say. Wise man. Yes, Rabbi Feinstein it is. But just to finish, I'll get to you in a second, but just to finish your question, technically, in the halachic process, we still do have a concept of consensus in some level, and there are questions that come up, and you can look around at respected halachic authorities worldwide, and it flows a certain direction. An example, without getting into it, it's not our topic, but electricity came on the scene. The consensus was it was not something to be used on Shabbos. Why? Everyone had their own opinion. But there was some consensus, sort of. So we do have a bit of it. So it's just harder to say if I have in front of me three rabbis who happen to be looking at a question. The answer is I still would, you know, sometimes questions come my way and I consult with a number of people. And if I'm hearing a certain thread and most of them are leaning a certain way, it's going to mean something to me. Absolutely. It's just harder to say like, well, I happen to have three here. Two happen to say A, one happens to say B. Boom, we have like a clear application of rule of majority. It's a little bit harder to apply it, but the concept does apply. Yes, Harley, and then Dave, and then we'll... You're good? Okay.
John.
You're first? You're second?
Go first.
What was that?
You can go first.
Okay.
That number of 600,000 to determine whether it's Rishus or Rabbi, Rishus at Yofi, it's not connected to anything. It's out of left field. I could have... He equally said the two because of the two Meraglim who came back with a good report. Or I could say 3 million as one of the opinions was, because it wasn't 600,000, it was 600,000 men, and then with all the other people. It's just not connected to the issue. It's out of left field. It makes you, gives the impression that the decisions are arbitrary.
So you're in good company.
Why would I ask a rabbi if his decision is going to be arbitrary when mine would be equally valid?
Right. So I'm not going to address that because it could be your opinion is equally valid. But
yeah. Sometimes
that's fine. That's fine. But I will address your question. Your question is a very fair question. It is not arbitrary because the entire structure of Shabbos law is inferred from the process of the Mishkan. And the entire concept of carrying in a public domain is inferred from the public domain that existed in the Jewish camp in the desert. So the verses that we're interpreting to be telling us not to carry in a public domain are specifically talking about that, and we have some... that's the locus of the conversation about public domains and about carrying in public domains. And that's what led Rashi to say it has to be like that public domain. It has to be public like that one. Others, Shulchan Aruch, who follows that way, and most other opinions, most likely, agree with you, Dave, and they say public means that it's used by the public. I mean, it's a street. People walk down, like, you know, start scratching your heads. You know, there are other definitions of the size, the width of it, and this is only one of the definitions of a public domain. But actually, most opinions agree with you. But Rashi's not coming from nowhere. He's actually well-grounded. But again, there's nothing in the Talmudic text or in the conversation that clearly says Rashi should be 100% right, which is why most disagree. But Rashi certainly wasn't coming from left field. Okay.
I had a question about the converse. So, if there were other cases where the Gemara or Mishnah or the Brises, where you say well, the person said this, but nobody follows it. So we can't even rely on it as a plan C. Everybody rejects it.
So, yes, meaning that the Talmud says that about Rabbi Meir, but there are... Meaning, like we mentioned, that the Ramah looks at the process. Meaning, we will take that. In other words, we'll stand today and we'll sit. An important part of halakhic decision is the process, and this is really the hallmark of orthodoxy. Really, is to stay true to this process. Whereas, if you go to another denomination of Judaism, you'll sometimes find a halakhic responsa that starts from the beginning. It says, okay, well, this is what it says in the Torah. I found such and such a Mishnaic era source. You know, I found it somewhere. It says that. Okay, it happens to be that seems like the conclusion of the Talmud is that, and the Rambam goes that way, and the Shulchan Aruch goes that way, and the Rush goes that way, and the Ramah goes that way, and people have been doing that for 2,000 years, but I'll go this way. I found a source, or... you know, I'll go that way. So that's one way to do it. That's not the orthodox way. The orthodox way is to say, this is the halachic process. And so if for 2,000 years of halachic process, opinion C has been ignored, then for the most part, opinion C is ignored. You come up with some hair-raising scenario and maybe it gets pulled out sometimes, but it almost entirely gets ignored when
an emergency.
I'm sorry?
I got an emergency circumstance.
Yeah, and honestly, sometimes you have emergency circumstances where there's not much to do. Like, so-and-so is doing X, and they're doing it anyways. Like, what do we do? I mean, you don't know... As much as we'd like everything to always be, like, we have the opportunity... You know, you study in yeshiva, and you learn the halacha, and you're like, okay, this is, you should do this. And then you get a phone call one day, and you don't have the opportunity to implement any of those straight, narrow halachic rulings. They're not applicable to the situation. They're just not. It's the right thing to happen, but it will not happen. And then it's important to know that opinion C exists because it could be relevant in such a scenario. But when you have an opinion that the majority of halakhic decisors throughout history have consistently gone the other way, and the Shulchan Aruch, which carries tremendous weight, has ignored, hasn't even quoted that. The major commentators in Shulchan Aruch don't quote it. So then we're not going to take it. We're not going to incorporate that very often.
Okay, so Rabbi Meir is quoted in the Gemara. So
the Gemara itself is saying Rabbi Meir is great. We don't always have the ability to take his to understand what he's saying, and so we don't necessarily always follow him. But it's good for us to know that he holds a certain way, because at times we're going to say, we are putting this in Rabbi Meir.
Okay, so
that's the idea.
So we know he's great because the Gemara says he's great.
This is the process at his time saying this. Meaning, his colleagues are saying this, or the generation following him.
Okay.
This is not us looking back and saying this. This is the halakhic process at the time saying this, and we do this today too. There can be a great rabbi today who has a bit of a unique opinion on something, and we're not going to follow his innovation. But sometimes it's good to know that someone who we know is pure, honest, and tremendous in their scholarship holds a certain way. It's important to know that.
Okay. So this throws some new light on many people who feel that Judaism is a religion of strict laws and handed down, and there's a certain way to do things and not another way to do things. So I think it's important as a general takeaway that we have this fluidity. There is fluidity in Jewish law interpretations, and maybe the greatest Jewish scholars and sages were able to see both sides of issues rather than being a certain rigid position, which many people feel these are the great people who have the strict orthodox are the ones who are really holding the religion together versus those who might be a little bit more lenient and more able to look in different angles at things. So there's a certain feeling that there's a certain the spirit of the law comes into play here, at least for me and many people who see a certain relativity in all of this, that what is it trying to tell us, the error? That there are certain things you should and should not be doing, and you should be paying attention to this. It's not willy-nilly. And at least for me, that spirit of the law is really very critical in understanding where Judaism wants us to go.
100%. I mean, the two points are extremely important, Neil. Extremely important. One is, and there's a bit of a distinction there between the a book written for a layman and the process of halacha for a halacha decisor. So if you're studying halacha as it should be applied in the best case scenario, you're going to get a much more cut and dry approach, because this is the best thing to do. This is the best thing to do. But if you are being trained to apply the halachic process, then you'd better understand the fluidity. But it takes quite a bit of scholarship. It takes quite a bit of training to appreciate what the process is, and it takes a deep sense of humility and reverence for the process and for the tradition to do that. And in the absence of any of those things. We get a mess, you know. So it's like there surely is a certain relativism there.
I think it's great that you put those caveats in there. Otherwise, we'll just say, well, this is what feels good to me, and I've read and studied Torah for 100 years, and it feels good to me. But you haven't really studied it in great depth and in great detail. Only then can you see both sides of the issues.
Right. And again, seeing both sides of the issue is not, well, I have a certain feeling, but seeing both sides of the issue is saying, well, Rashi and the Bahag understood it this way. There's 17 other mitigating factors, which I didn't get into because, like I said, we'll be here all day, but there's, with an error, there are numerous other mitigating factors to say, well, even the other opinion would agree, right? And there's like 5 or 10 of those arguments and hundreds of pages written to say. So we're talking about taking all of that in consideration and then coming to an understanding of what practically to do. Yes, Alex, you want to say something?
Just curious, do we understand that they had an
Eruv in the Mikvah? So we don't understand that they had an Eruv. To the contrary, we understand that that was considered a public domain, and that transferring to the wagon, which we understand to be a private domain, from the public domain was considered an act of carrying.
So people weren't bringing cow or
children
to each other's tents?
Correct, unless, yeah, that's our understanding, I think.
I don't know if this is valid or true, but I understand that the issue of whether you're allowed to turn on electric light on Shabbos is Halacha was by Moshe Feinstein. I understand that that's what I heard, and it was in the 1940s. Until then, it was debated, etc., etc. Does anyone know the basis of the decision of why you can't turn on the lights with it?
So, I mean, I wouldn't pin it on a Moshe Feinstein, and I would deflect that question just because it's a very involved conversation, and numerous opinions. But it predated him, meaning as soon as it came out, they're like, okay, what do we do with this? And as my understanding is, pretty much all great halakhic authorities said, well, this is not something we use on Shabbos, and this one said, well, it's because of this. And then as we understood more of electricity, clearly he wasn't understanding it right. Another person said, no, it's that. And we're like, okay, is it that? No, it's not. Most, you know. It's a mess. We're happy to get into some other time, but not for now. But I wouldn't pin it on Moshe Feinstein. It wasn't him. I think it was consensus that it was to be avoided, but there wasn't a consensus why. Which is it violate this Shabbos law? Does it violate the other Shabbos law? Is it the other one or the other one? You know, everyone fought back and forth.
Hanging in the air, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
That leaves it hanging in the air. Nobody knows why, but they just decided that this is the way it's going to be.
I will deflect that question because it's not. I can't answer that in a minute. I cannot answer it in a minute. I'm sorry. I can't.
Your common sense says what?
Make your own decisions.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't think the rabbi.
Thank God that you can turn the light on.
That's right. That's right.
Just turn it on before Shabbos.
And nowadays it's all set up. You could set it up for the next 100 years that it should operate according to you. It should be a little on later for your birthday and whatever. So, okay. Any other comments or questions? No. Anything?
You know, I never did this, but there are other issues. A lot of issues that need, like abortion. Let's say you have a terribly malformed child. Mm-hmm. Now he's a week old, or what do you do? I mean, he's going to have a horrible life, might live for 150 years. It's going to be major problems for the parents, but they can handle it. You could say to yourself, if it's not you that's handling it, it's them. Is the abortion allowed in that case? Not allowed?
100%. Those are important questions. Those are important questions. And there's a process for the decision. And the process is not... Sometimes you're in a vacuum. In other words, someone asks you, should I do this or that? And there's no precedent, there's no formula rules in halacha. But when you deal with murder, with taking a life potentially, so there's lots of halachic literature and rules to take into consideration. So you have to take all of the things into consideration, including the impact on the family, including the quality of life. You have to take all those things in consideration, render a ruling based on your knowledge. But it's not a question of, well, you know, I think this is right, and I really feel it strongly, and I'm a rabbi. That's why I said I would ask them why they say it. It was like, because I think it's right. That's nice, but that's not halacha. So that would be that. Okay, I don't know how much time we have. I think we're wrapping up, right, Rabbi Summers? Another 5 minutes? Okay, so to talk about the idea of custom, sorry?
There's also the issue of based in shopping. You know, I have an issue, and I've heard that if I go to this based in and not that based in, they'll be more understanding,
correct,
more lenient. So.
Yeah, it's you want to be consistent if you can, for sure.
Can we get back to the silver?
Yes, let's try. So let's try in a little bit to get to some of the things which we're not going to finish, which is a notorious track record of mine. But let's at least try to talk a little bit. So case study number two, we're going to skip. Essentially, case study number two shows that what you would think would be the halacha if you look at the text, and is the preferred course of action the Shulchan Aruch wants you to take, which is to wash your hands when you have a wet apple, is not common practice. So it's a disagreement among the early commentators of the Talmud. And what we find Shulchan Aruch preferring us to act strictly, it never got traction, seemingly. And the custom is lenient. So we see the power of custom. Right? We see the power of custom because, importantly, the power of the Jewish people is actually one of the most important aspects of rabbinic law, which is that we the people took upon ourselves X. We the people took upon ourselves Y. There are many halachos that are considered absolutely binding today that were our invention, that came from the bottom up. It wasn't even like the rabbi said, here's a law and let's see if it has traction, but actually we started just doing something and it became such a strong custom that it becomes binding on future generations. So that's the power of custom is important.
Can you give an example?
I just did. So the washing hands for a wet fruit was an example of custom there. There's another question which we did a class a few years ago for a legal thing we did with the Kollel. It's a whole other thing, and that's about, and it has to do with a general topic here, and that's about staying true to the spirit of the law versus looking for loopholes, even when you found a technical loophole. But it's not true to the spirit of the law. So I'll draw a contrast between selling your chametz, and which is case number three, and case number one in the halachic subterfuge and staying true to the spirit of the law section, which is that some people would like to get around having to take the tithe from their grain. So there, the spirit of the law is you should support the poor. The spirit of the law is you should support the Levite, you should support the Kohen. That's very clear. That's the spirit of the law. So it happens to be that technically the law takes effect when the grain is brought into the house. So I have a pulley system, I brought it in through the roof, and I don't have to take the tithe. Well, what's the spirit of the law? The spirit of the law is that you should be taking from what you're bringing in and what you're bringing home, you should take some of it and you should give it away to someone who's less fortunate than you. You should take some of it and use it to support the Kohen or the Levi who are dedicated to serving Hashem. That's the spirit of the law. And your workaround is against the spirit of the law. And that's an important thing to consider. The Talmud says in Brachos that is not cool. That's not a good thing to do, right? It says, look at these people. They're not as great as earlier generations because this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to get around. They're trying to shirk their responsibilities, essentially. That's one kind of thing. The case number three is you're selling your chametz. Now, there's a whole, I don't know if you saw, there's a really funny video, I can send it to you if you want later, about this guy in Israel. He opens up his, he hears these noises, and he goes in his cabinet where he sold his chametz, and there's all these noises coming, and he opens it up, and there's an Arab there smoking an argila. He's like, what are you doing here? He's like, what do you mean? You sold me, you sold this to me. This is my space over Pesach. And he's like, no, I never meant that, you know. So there's that question. Is it a sham or is it real? And why is it different than getting around the tithing thing? And the answer is, well, what's the spirit of the law? The spirit of the law is that you're not supposed to own chametz. You can argue on this, but at least an argument can be made that the idea in the Torah is don't eat chametz, don't own chametz, don't have anything to do with it for Pesach. If it's somewhere in a designated place, it's cordoned off, it's taped off, it doesn't legally belong to you, you're not supposed to have contact with it, touch it, you're not seeing it, that's fine. The Torah doesn't say you have to purge your home of chametz. It says you should purge the areas that you own, the areas that you're going to come in contact with, and so on and so forth. So that's, again, it's interpretation, it's application.
Can you have a contract to sell your chametz to someone that stipulates that they are not allowed to utilize it and they must allow you to exercise an option to purchase it later?
No.
You cannot,
I mean, you can exercise an option to purchase it later, may be complex, but that they can't use it, no. I mean, no, absolutely.
They own it.
And they their stories where, you know, they have come, but it's not, it's very rare.
Could the contract say that they're not allowed to use it for a finite period of time, like, say, 2 weeks, 30 days?
No.
Like a pawn shop, similar to a pawn shop.
I mean, again, we can get into, like, could you maybe have such a contract? I'll tell you what the contract does say. It does say, basically, the non-Jew purchasing the chametz pays a small upfront amount, and they have an option after whatever, at the end of Pesach, to either follow through with the purchase, which then obligates them to pay whatever the remainder is, or at that point they can choose to sell it back. But it's a choice they're making to sell it back. Just very briefly, Rabbi Heineman of the Star K in Baltimore, he said that he was always like the halacha guy to go to when he was in yeshiva. So this guy got married and all this whiskey people gave him as a gift. He said, take care of it for Pesach for me. So he goes to a non-Jew that he knows in the area and he says, here's the deal. I'm going to give this to you. You're going to give me $10 now. After Pesach, I'm going to come back. And if you want to go through on the purchase, you're going to give me another $150. If not, well, I'll give you the $10 back. You're going to give me the whiskey back and fine and great. Comes to him after Pesach and he's like, so about the whiskey? He's like, what whiskey? He's like, so the whiskey's like, I drank it all. So Rabbi Henry said that was a good sale of chametz. You know, that was done right. That was done right. But it is a real contractually. We try to jump through like several different transactional things. We do a document and we give money and we do a handoff and we do this and we do that and we try it to our very best that it should be as halachically legal of a sale as possible. And the preference is, you know, that should be as real as possible. But at the end of the day, the chances of the non-Jew coming to drink your whiskey are very slim. But to put something into the document that renders the transaction void would be a major halachic issue. So that's the question. If you're supposed to give tithes, don't find a legal loophole that says don't give the tithes. If you're looking to not own chametz, and there are different ways of not owning chametz, okay, then there may be other ways that are okay. That is an example. Just to give one final example, Taz talks about immersing utensils in a mikvah. So we know that when you buy something from a non-Jew, whether it's from Walmart or from your next door neighbor at a garage sale, if you buy a utensil, you have to make sure that it wasn't used for non-kosher food, but let's say it's new. So if it's made out of metal, let's just say we immerse it in the mikvah. So what happens if there's no mikvah? I'm on vacation in wherever, Yehopetzville, like they say, and there's no mikvah, but I have this new grill, I have this new pot, and I need to use it. And so what do? So one thing you can do is go over to the non-Jewish guy in the hotel room next to you and say, listen, I have this bind, you know, I don't know what to do. Would you mind if I gift this to you or sell it to you for a dollar? And do you mind if I borrow it? Is that okay? And first he looks at you like you're fell off the moon. And then after enough convincing, he's like, okay, whatever, who cares? You know, fine, I'll do you a favor. So the Taz says, you know, maybe to do that on a one-off time, okay, it is a sale enacted just for one purpose, but is it the same as chametz? We can say maybe it's okay. But says the Taz, if you're going to do that long-term, and you're going to use that grill, and that grill's in your backyard, it's in your porch of your long-term stay where you're doing work in, I don't know, southern Colorado, whatever, and you're using it, it's yours, come on, it's yours. Right? That's what the Taz says. It's yours, you're using it. So the chametz, you're putting it away, it's there, it's cordoned off, it's sold, there's a sign on it that says it's not mine, fine. But you take this thing, you're using it, and to do it, for sure to do it for a period of time, says the Taz, that is a sham. That actually isn't valid. That is his opinion. So we do see that. So even within the technicalities, we always have to be true to the technicalities of Jewish law. Again, it's not about what I feel. There's a process, to be true to the process. Even when I am true to the process, I also have to be true to the spirit. And that, again, can sometimes be one way, sometimes the other way. But that's the basic that's the basic idea here. And we'll hold it there, I think. I'll turn it over to Rabbi Summers to tell you goodbye, or I don't know, if you close with something. Thank you, Rabbi Summers, for inviting me.
Sure.
And Shkoyach, thank you for having me.